There's no combination of words I could put on. Good afternoon and welcome to the Insight Teen Hour. I'm Frederick. I'm the owner of Insight Treatment Programs here in Santa Clarita. It's a teen treatment program. It's a program where we focus on helping teenagers struggling with mental health and drug and alcohol issues. So every Monday at 2 p.m., we have this show where we're talking about anything that's relevant to teen mental health in our effort to sort of reduce and ensure or encourage conversations about teen mental health. Today, I wanted to talk about trust. I think that everybody almost, or all the families that come to Insight, they're all struggling with building up the trust between the teens and the parents. There is always things that has been going on that has sort of put the family in a situation where the family dynamics are struggling a bit, and whether the teen has been self-harming or has had suicidal thoughts or has been using drugs, the idea is that there usually is a lot of trust issues. The teens doesn't trust that the parents has their best interest. The teen doesn't, and the parents don't trust the teens anymore. They're scared that if they don't keep things under control, then bad things can happen. So there's usually a lot of work that needs to be done related to the trust in the family, to build up that trust, generate that trust. Some teens or some parents obviously has some trauma that makes it hard to build up the trust. So today in the studio, I've invited a bit of an expert, Mervyn Meyer here, who has been working with teens and families for about 40 years, or more than 40 years, and who has a lot of great things to say about how to build up trust, how to use some simple tools to work on that in the family. So welcome to the studio, Mervyn. Thanks for coming in, and thanks for taking your time.
Thank you, Frederick, and good afternoon to you and to all of your listeners. Thank you so much for having me on the Insight Treatment Hour. And today I'd like to talk about attachment disruption, trauma, and blocked trust, and how we can work with a teen to help them develop strong, trusting relationships with their parents.
Yes.
And caregivers.
And I know, sorry, Mervyn, but I just wonder, you've obviously worked in the industry for a long time, and before we go into the actual details, but what brought you to the industry originally, and how, yeah?
Oh, originally over 40 years ago, I was, you know, certainly interested in a lot of different things. I had kind of made a pact with myself that I wanted to have an impact on people in whatever shape or form that would take. I thought at first that was going to be in the area of being a professional musician and writing songs and introducing them, you know, out to the world. However, as things would go, I found that really wasn't my forte, and I started, you know, looking around where I could fulfill my goal and have a greater impact upon the world. And starting with the idea of one person at a time certainly brought me to the direction of becoming a licensed marriage and family therapist, which I have been for over 40 years, which you've mentioned and I've mentioned already twice.
Yeah. Well, it is unique, right? Because I can't stress enough that, A, we need people to work in this industry. You know, we're struggling. They're struggling to find enough resources at the moment. But B, I also think it's so valuable because a lot of people, you know, can unfortunately burn out in this industry, right? It can be a lot of – so for you to be in here for 40 years, I think that's awesome. Thanks for it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. In this time, I worked in a lot of different therapeutic areas, including community-based counseling agencies, private practice, residential treatment. And actually, out of the 13 years that I worked in residential treatment with adolescents, the last 7 years were spent working in Italy.
Oh, wow.
And we had a residential treatment program there. And along with never eating so well in my life, The experience in Italy deeply influenced my work with families and furthered my knowledge of really the importance of supporting and nurturing the family unit. I think for a long time, the family has gotten a bad notices. And I think it came with the idea and the words, I think from Bradford about the dysfunctional family, and sort of put all the negative emphasis on related to the family rather than working with the positive components of the family and helping them to strive and to become a much more healthy family unit. So I really take a look at working with the family from really a strengths-based basis, and to help them to work with what they got, not from a perspective of what they don't have.
No.
And to help support them in that regard. So when I returned to the U.S. in 1995, as I said, I worked at community agencies, and I was a therapist, supervisor, consultant, and finally a program director for a program that provided opportunities for students that were in special education and counseling opportunities. In 2004, I believe it was, I was introduced to Dr. Daniel Hughes, who was the founder and developer of Dyadic Developmental Psychotherapy. That's a mouthful, so we just call it DDP. And that particular model is really based upon the idea of working with children and teens and helping they and their families to develop better attachment, connection, and to help them work through issues of trauma. Originally, Dr. Hughes, who's written the books Building the Bonds of Attachment, Brain-Based Parenting, Attachment-Focused Therapy, and Healing Relational Trauma, he developed this to work with foster and adopt families. After a time, it was really witnessed to be extremely useful in working with children and teens and their biological families, where there had been attachment, disconnection, disruption, and trauma. I trained with Dr. Hughes and became a certified Dyadic Developmental Psychotherapy Institute practitioner, consultant, and trainer. And since 2006, I've worked solely in private practice, working with children, teens, couples, families, and individuals that come to me with trauma and attachment issues. I feel my mission is really to share the import of DDP, the model, with parents, families, care workers, therapists, and educators. I've taught DDP trainings throughout the U.S., the U.K., and Europe, and I truly embrace this mission with excitement and heartfelt commitment. I practiced in Northern California coming back from Italy from 1995, and then 2020, my wife, Rose, and I decided to move to the San Gabriel Valley to be near to our adult children who were having their own children, and to be nearer to our grandchildren, extended family, and longtime friends. Mm. I have practices in Monrovia and Pasadena, where I provide both virtual and in-person sessions. I work with families, couples, and individuals.
Great.
For the purposes of our talk today, Frederick, I'll focus specifically on working with teens, parents, and families. If people would like to get in touch with me to discuss their situation at the end of the show, I will mention my private practice telephone number and give my email address as well.
Great, Mervyn. Now that we're on this topic, do you take insurance in your private practice, or is it private pay? Do you have some sort of scaling?
That's a good question, Frederick. Most of my people that I work with are fee-for-service, so that means that they're paying me directly out of pocket, so to speak. And I do, however, work with one insurance company which is Aetna Insurance. I have to sort of moderate the number of those clients and where I can fit them in and into my day so that I can also make space for those people that are totally fee-for-service clients.
Great. Mervyn, so before we sort of go into maybe some of the details about PACE or DDP, or I just have a bigger question to ask you, because a lot of parents sort of come to me, I feel, and say, look, how come that this relationship between my 16 or 17-year-old teenager and us as parents, how come that that's so important, considering that this is also the time in their lives where they typically would, you know, try and get their independence, would move away from mom and dad, would not be, try to live without their, you know, I wouldn't say relationship, but there's this funny thing happening, right? And on one hand, we want the teens at that stage in their life to move out and do their own thing and get their own experiences. But at the same time, this relationship between parents and teens are so crucial in those years still. And, you know, obviously teens are in many ways showing, hey, I don't need a relationship. I don't, you know, it's about my friends. It's about peer support. It's not about my relationship to parents anymore. Do you have any input? Do you have anything that you've been, that you feel that, hey, this is why that relationship is so important to nurture, even at that stage of a teenage life?
Sure, Frederick. Yeah, I'd be happy to answer that. Well, I think it's most important, you know, to look at that, you know, what we start with in terms of, you know, our relationship with our children then gets fostered and develops as kids become teenagers, and with, as you say, them wanting to begin to find their own way and become, you know, fostering themselves into the adult world. At the same time, you know, there's a bit of conflict that's there in terms of their need to emancipate and also their need to hold on to their parents and their parents' thoughts, ideas, values, expectations as well. And I think which really gets said very well in the title of a book, and I can't remember the author's name right at the moment, but it's the title goes something like, Mom and Dad, I want you out of my life, but before you will you take Cheryl and me to the mall? So
yes,
it really speaks very clearly in terms of the dynamic that's there with teenagers. And much in the case that we may need to back off a bit and stop hovering or directing them to, you know, every little piece of their life, they still have a need to have that relationship and that relationship connection, that is most important. If we just look at, for example, the whole aspect of emotional regulation, mm-hmm. Okay, children, teenagers cannot learn self-regulation without having been co-regulated. So important for their parents to be there and involved and supporting them and helping them with issues as they go through this world, which this world has become certainly, you know, much more complicated and much more difficult to manage than when we were children and we were teenagers. So I hope that answers your question, Frederick.
No, it absolutely does. Thanks for that perspective. And yes, it is absolutely true. Teenagers are going through things that we didn't go through when we were kids, right? I mean, mm-hmm. They are challenged with things that I remember there was a parent that said to me at some point, Frederick, my kid is always telling me, well, you don't know what it's like to be me, or you don't know what it's like to be a teenager mm-hmm. right now. And reality mm-hmm. is, I think that is true, right? They're literally being forced to engage and to handle things that we have never been forced to face, right?
Right.
It's definitely, you know, things have changed a lot for these teens.
Right.
But, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say that, you know, so many of the teens that I see oftentimes with their parents in terms of, you know, attitude and behavior kinds of problems, you know, present feelings of anger, loss, loneliness, isolation, abandonment, hopelessness, and which, you know, most of these problems manifest and experiences and feelings most commonly in problems like mood disorders and anxiety and depression. And I think it's important that parents understand this and understand that their kids are experiencing, you know, a great deal. And whether they're, you know, their experience is somewhat influenced by household troubles, which could be divorce, violence, emotional abuse, neglect, drug or alcohol addiction. All of these influence their children negatively. And also looking at the complications which we were just talking about in terms of the world and all the things that they have to deal with in terms of, you know, the external issues of the environment, climate crisis, natural disasters, domestic terrorism, war, the COVID pandemic. And then you add into it, you know, just social issues, you know, created by school peers and the influence of all the social media culture. There's a lot for these kids to have to be dealing with, and it affects the teen's emotional, physical, spiritual, and mental health.
Absolutely. Mervyn, I think we have to go into a little break now. I'm being told we got a few more minutes to go. But Mervyn, what would you say? So I know when we spoke earlier, you talked about the blocked trust in the brain, right? How do we unlock that? Can you elaborate a bit on that? What do you mean by that? And how do you work with families on that?
Well, let me speak to that a little bit later.
Okay.
We will get to that. Frederick, let me just, I'd like to, you know, just kind of give a shout out to all parents who seek services, whether they're coming to see me, you know, individually in private practice, whether they're seeking out your services as part of Insight treatment, that parents are really pushing themselves, and they're pushing themselves to face their own demons, mm-hmm. you know, their own sense of helplessness and hopelessness of, you know, what's going on with their teens. Because I think most parents, and you could attest to this, really love their teens.
Absolutely.
And they come to us with feelings of guilt and shame. And they're not only admitting that their child has a problem, but they're also struggling as well, too. And that they need help, and they need help to help their child succeed.
Absolutely.
And so parents are as much a part of this process and being really an intimate partner in their child's treatment process, which means that participating in parent sessions and family sessions as well.
Very true. I often hear from parents who have gone through the program, right? And I asked them, so when did you really see a change in the teen's behavior? When did you see a progress in your family? And they basically all say the same thing. They say, well, when we started working the program, when we started putting down our guards and being vulnerable and sort of acknowledging that we had to change as well, that was when we saw the progress. That was when it all started. When we started to surrender to the idea that there were probably something we had to learn as parents, and we didn't know it all, that's when the real progress happens, and that's when the teens start changing their behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's that word you use, vulnerability, and also that other word that you used, you know, taking down their guard, which is so meaningful and helpful because, you know, then the teenager doesn't feel like that they are the only focus, that it's all of their problem, that a parent is saying, this is not just your problem. This is a problem for all of us, and we're working together to solve this problem.
Yeah, that's a great point.
The teenager doesn't feel that sense of abandonment, you know, but feels that they've got a ring around them of all of those people that are there you know, helping to support them, as well as all the practitioners that are working with them to support them and their family.
Correct. It takes a village, right, to go
it
through
does.
Something.
It and does.
I, and
yeah.
I think that comes with, you know, parents often, at least many parents that I talk to, often feel that they are supposed to know. You know, we are supposed to know what works for our kids and how to be and how to support them. And you know, it can be hard to sometimes acknowledge, no, I don't really know, because there is no manual for how to be a parent. And you might have three kids and two of them is great and everything is running smooth, and then there's one that's struggling behind because he or she needs love and attention and sort of in a different way, right?
Right.
But Mervyn, I think we have to go into this break now. So
okay.
You're all listening to KHTS 98.1 FM, and this is the Insight Teen Hour. And here on the show today, you got Frederick Schulin and Mervyn. Sorry, Mervyn, Meyer here. I've had a brain fart here for a second. But we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
There's no combination of words.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Insight Teen Hour. I'm Frederick from Insight Treatment Programs here in Santa Clarita. And on the studio today, I got Mervyn Meyer, who is an LMFT and got his private practice. And Mervyn has been in our field for more than 40 years. And he's talking to us today about relationships in the family and how important it is to build up the relationship and work on these relationships with things like pace. And Mervyn, before we start, you know, I would love for you to elaborate a little bit about how the biology plays into the relationship in the family.
Sure.
I know we spoke about that in the break. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Interpersonal neurobiology refers to, you know, the how the body, brain, and mind functions really within the context of our relationships. And, you know, first of all, to know that we all need to feel safe in our environment and with our caretakers. And, you know, when we do, we can create the brain pathways that will help us to fully develop physically, emotionally, intellectually, and socially. Each child needs to feel that their parents, caretakers are available, sensitive, responsive, and reparative by their attitude and their behavior. You know, however, you know, when there's disruptions in home and the environment, this can really threaten a child's safety. And this can happen, you know, even, you know, with a child who's in utero, when a mother's life is chaotic and she's releasing stress-induced hormones, this can impact the unborn child. Mm-hmm. This can happen when a mom experiences postpartum depression and becomes less available in the needs of their newborn. This can happen with, you know, parents who were involved in domestic violence, and a child is there witnessing this. And so it disrupts and impacts the central nervous system and impacts the brain in terms of its full ability to develop and to develop those particular parts, especially we're talking about the front of the brain, which is right behind the forehead here, which we call the prefrontal cortex, which is so important in terms of our thoughts, problem solving, managing our emotions, etc. But rather than spending too much information and time on that, let me give you an example of a child, child teen I worked with that had early disruptive attachment. This is a very bright, sensitive young man who had many sort of sensory proclivities, which included ADHD. And when he was younger, his mother contracted breast cancer shortly after his sister's birth. Mm-hmm. And kind of because of the combination of the mother's cancer treatment, his little sister's needs, his father working, and father's concern for his wife, the boy was left without healthy support. And he was temporarily farmed out to his maternal grandmother for care. Unfortunately, she lacked the nurturing qualities and had very high expectations for him way beyond his chronological age. By the time that parents got him into family treatment, he was anxious, he was depressed, and he was pretty self-loathing. When things were not going well in his life, he would frequently voice that he wanted to kill himself. Working with he and his parents and eventually including his sister, things improved tremendously for this boy and the family. They all gained the tools, which I'll explain later, that helped him to regain the security, the trust that he had lost as a young boy, and discovered he was able to discover a greater sense of self-worth. Mm-hmm. So attachment, security, and connection can be damaged by their children's caretakers. And this, you know, in short, can be called developmental trauma. This occurs interpersonally and generally within the family. It's devastating because the trauma comes by way of the caregivers, most caused by parents or lack of protecting them, you know, in a continual series of traumatic events. It's generally premeditated, prolonged trauma, which will affect the child's long-term development. This, in turn, will impact their ability to create healthy neuropathways that help them to grow to their full potential. Because it happens on the primary caregiver's watch, the child's developed distrust of their parents and adults alike. So consequently, they will do anything and everything in their power to not trust parents and caretakers who may have put them in harm's way. This is thought and action tells them that they should not risk getting close, so it will never happen again. So these kids generally become prematurely self-reliant and independent, lacking emotional support and nurturance needed for healthy relationships. Frederick, this is what Dan Hughes and John Balin call block trust. Mm-hmm. Kids will block the pain of rejection and the capacity to feel delight in order to survive a world without comfort and joy. I can give you an example of block trust here as we move along here. I saw a family which was paternal aunt and uncle who brought their teenage nephew into therapy. The narrative was that this young man's older sister had lost their mother to cancer, again, a cancer situation. The young man's father was devastated, sunk into a depression. He medicated himself with marijuana and physically and mentally withdrew from his son and daughter, leaving them to fend for themselves. After time, the father, uneducated in his children's needs, allowed himself to be guided by a girlfriend for parenting support. Unfortunately, she had a military background and created a an extremely restrictive physical and emotional and mental abusive environment. The father's restrictions included hours of standing time for this boy, taping his window shut so that no light was ever visible, restricted his bathroom and meal times. He couldn't even eat with the rest of the family. He was constantly the brunt of verbal abuse, and he was remanded to serve 200 hours of outside cleanup as restitution just for a minor stain on one of the bathroom floors. And he wasn't even responsible for this.
No.
When this was discovered by the authorities, the boy and the sister were eventually removed and sent to live with the aunt and the uncle. I'll say in the beginning of our therapy and our work together, his aunt reported that the young man would constantly excuse himself from any and all family interaction, restricting himself to his room, bathroom, and the garage, which was set up as a man cave so he could play video games. His aunt, who was very warm, very nurturing, and so willing to love this boy, through her giving hugs and preparing, you know, healthy, wholesome food, was just totally devastated by his rejection. She felt helpless and unable to show what they cared for, that they cared for this boy and that they loved him. Kind of adding to the difficulty, this young man, influenced by his father's attitude and behavior and the shame that his father seduced him into believing, would say, as a way of explaining his father's behavior and why he didn't deserve other people's kindness, he said this literally, Frederick, mm-hmm. Parents that abuse their children only do it because they love them. Mm. I'll say that one more time. Parents that abuse their children only do it because they love them. This was stunning.
Yeah.
But this teen could believe that because that was his only choice, was to believe his perpetrator and to feel some safe, you know, to feel some safety in the home, or if he was to disbelieve it, risk further abuse. So it took some time and a lot of work for this boy to accept that he was lovable and worthwhile, and that the love of his aunt and uncle gave to him was real, trustworthy, and unconditional. This led to the unblocking of his trust. So, given sort of the time that we have, I won't go into, you know, how this disruption plays in terms of the brain, but I will mention the needs of a particular child and what Dan Hughes and John Balin called the six goals for them to begin to move from mistrust to trust. The six goals are to enable them to experience a gut sense of safety, to enable them to trust and recover the ability to experience sadness and seek comfort. 3, to restore their capacity for playfulness. 4, to increase their readiness and to be open and engaged with others with their own reflective abilities. 5, to increase their readiness for curiosity. And 6, enable them to experience themselves as being the source of delight to others while being of sufficient value and to be given comfort in distress. Now, dyadic developmental psychotherapy, which I refer to as DDP here, there are many different ways of generating this through DDP, but I thought I would just share one with you that I think is really helpful and really has the ability to help to flip the switch from mistrust to trust. It's a way of thinking, feeling, communicating, and behaving that really aims to make people feel safe and emotionally connected. And that's in the stance which Dan Hughes calls PACE. And PACE is an acronym which stands for, well, I should say, P stands for playfulness, A stands for acceptance, C for curiosity, and the E is for empathy. So I'm just going to go in to talk a little bit about each one of these, if you don't mind, Frederick.
Of course.
Okay. So playfulness with an adolescent is really taking the attitude of being light, open, engaged, an attitude that really leads to connection and generates hope. It's everything that we see that babies need, you know, someone delighting in them. When teens experience this and you can get them to laugh, giggle, they become less defensive. They're less withdrawn. They're more reflective. I can give you a perfect example. One boy came into my office, and he had his hair that was one half streaked with with blue. And so I spent a little time and just sort of teased him a little bit without being judgmental. We talked about his blue hair and how he worked on making it blue and all of that. And then here I am with my gray hair, and I said to him, how do you think I would look with that blue hair? Do you think you would mind kind of, putting some blue rinse into my hair? And he laughed and he giggled, and we had, quite a conversation about that. And that really helped to forward our relationship and his feeling like oh, he had somebody that could be playful with him, that coming to therapy wasn't necessarily, you know, all doom and gloom and wasn't going to be heavy.
Yes.
So playfulness applies to this mistrusting brain, and it helps to generate surprise. Teens and parents that get into really unhealthy patterns, you know, for example, an adolescent is expecting a stern and severe response to their misbehavior. But instead, if a parent can respond with playfulness, this is going to trigger a connection response rather than a distancing response. This will be interpreted and will be an expected reoccurrence, shocking the youth's brain. This will minimize offensiveness, aggression, and coldness.
Yes, I can. Sorry, go ahead, Mervyn.
Oh, okay. Another example, you know, parents oftentimes come with, you know, certain things that are happening on a continual basis in a family. And they may be small, however, they're important to that particular family. So, you know, oftentimes parents will be exasperated that their child hasn't taken the trash out. It leads to anger, demeaning statements, and, you know, teaching the parent to approach their teen, starting with a smile, then looking them in the eye, reaching out to shake their hand, and then with a friendly tone, suggest that they take the trash out. Most often, the trash will be taken out, and it will all also create a new connection in the teen's brain. You and I, you know, if someone were to do that with us, we would be more likely to take the trash out as well, Frederick.
Of course. I hear you.
The second piece of PACE is acceptance, and that is really the commitment to the teen's internal experience. And this is a willingness to accept their thoughts, feelings, wishes, desires, motives. It's really unconditional acceptance, and it's really a core to the child's safety. I worked with a young man and a mother, and the boy had developed severe kidney disorder and had isolated from school and friends for a couple of years. And while in session with he and his mother, his mother expressed concern about how he was being bullied and wanted the behavior to stop. And while she was right and was a reasonable request, when I started to share with her in front of her son that her son was obviously, you know, jealous of the younger brother because he had friends. He was able to live a normal life with school, sports, and hanging out with people, and it was unfairness. Then this particular boy had tears coming down his eyes. These were real crocodile tears. And the mother could finally understand that this boy's experience was one that was so, so actually tragic and traumatic for him. Not that this changed her attitude about his picking on his younger brother, but it gave her new knowledge and compassion for him.
Yeah, that is a...
So acceptance applies to the teen with a mistrusting brain, and the teen expects that this behavior will be evaluated immediately and negatively. With acceptance, he realizes that your relationship with him is more important than his behavior. I'm going to move on quickly because I know we're kind of short of time here.
But you know what? Sorry, Mervyn. Sorry. We need to go into a little break. We will have to come back to curiosity and empathy here in the end. As soon as we come back from the break. So,
okay.
You're listening to KHTS 98.1 FM, and this is the Insight Teen Hour. In a couple of minutes, we'll be back with the remaining topics here.
There's no combination. No,
and welcome back to the Insight Teen Hour. So today we're talking to Mervyn Meyer, who's an LMFT, and he is explaining the PACE model to us, basically a model that parents should know or use or be mindful of, where the model is basically making sure that we pay attention to things like playfulness, acceptance, curiosity, and empathy when we're developing our relationship with our teens or growing that relationship. So, Mervyn, I know when we stopped for the break, you had just finished your explaining acceptance and how important that is. Maybe we could jump straight into it and talk more about curiosity and how parents can show curiosity as they're building up this relationship.
Sure. I'll jump right in with curiosity. Okay. Curiosity and more curiosity really helps to develop a greater insight, awareness into your child's, your adolescent's thinking, feeling, and behavior. What grows for a parent is a greater appreciation for their teen, their inner world, and really creates a deeper level of understanding of who your child is. You know, for example, a parent, all you parents that are listening out there, instead of asking maybe the question, why did you do that? Instead ask, help me to understand why you acted this way. What led you to that choice? If you still don't understand, without being judgmental, say, I still don't understand. Could you tell me more about that? How curiosity applies to the mistrusting brain is that it shows that we are first interested in really understanding the meaning of their actions. The behavior is seen as communicating something about their teen's inner life that may be important. We can respond more to the meaning of the behavior rather than the behavior itself. Now, the last one, E for empathy. I like to quote the psychologist researcher Brené Brown, who defines empathy. Empathy is connecting with people, so we know we're not alone when we're in a struggle. Empathy is a way to connect to the emotion another person is experiencing, and it doesn't require that we have to experience the same situation that they are going through. As a parent, it communicates to your teen your acceptance and curiosity and allows them, meaning your teen, to experience your compassion for them. When they experience empathy from their parent, loving adult, then they can feel more likely to experience empathy for themselves. For today's teens, there's so many things out there that their parent, peers, society may judge them for, which creates feelings of shame. Many of the teens I work with experience a deep shame. With the advent of the social media, teens' experience can be viewed and unthoughtfully judged by thousands in minutes. They will need their parents' empathy because empathy is really the antidote to shame. Some of you out there may experience that your teen doesn't want shame, and that's oftentimes true because it may make them feel too vulnerable. Then you will need to emphasize playfulness, acceptance, and curiosity until they can tolerate empathy. You go slower, you're more gentler, and you try to integrate into your attitude that aspect of empathy because they need it. Their pain needs to be shared with an adult. Empathy is really the strongest relational intervention we have. And PACE helps to provide that. The whole PACE being playfulness, acceptance, and curiosity. And for the mistrusting brain, the teenage brain, it creates an element of surprise that works on parts of the brain to help to discombobulate previous experiences, which create new neural pathways of trust, allowing your teen to evaluate themselves and their parents and caretakers and adults in a healthier, trustful, and more vulnerable ways so that they can embrace the world rather than hiding from it. PACE will help to extinguish the fear of getting close. PACE will help to reverse the old ways of learning about interactions and create healthy reflection. PACE will vigorously resolve mistrust versus trust conflict, and it will shift the sets and allow negative beliefs to be extinguished and positive beliefs to be built. There's more to be said, but I think we've run a bit out of time here, Frederick. So let me just mention that I can be reached by telephone at area code 707 707-992-5238. That's 707-992-5238. Or at mmaier, so that's M-M-A-I-E-R, M-F-T, at sonic, S-O-N-I-C, .net. Or you can check out my website, which is MervinMeyerMFT.com. So those are the ways to, you know, reach out to me. And if you're, you know, interested in family, teamwork, or, you know, any individual work.
Great, Mervin. This is really, really helpful. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, the teen hour is about to be over, but thank you very much for your time to come on the show, Mervin. I really appreciate it. I think this framework and this perspective has been very, very helpful. And I truly do believe that a lot of teens that come in that needs help, they do have some sort of mistrusting brain, right? As you say, they are in a position where they don't trust adults. And often parents don't necessarily know that something has taken place that has allowed for the teens to feel that way, right? I feel sometimes parents are not mindful of these things or don't know that it has taken place. But thank you very much, Mervin. I really appreciate it. And here at Insight, we will be back next Monday at 2 p.m. for the Insight Teen Hour.
Thank you, friend.
I believe.